Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is All of It. In today's installment of Taking Care of You in 22, we are going to talk about big emotions because, as we will learn from our next guest, not talking about emotions, feeling our feelings is not sustainable. Liz Fosslyn, not feeling our feelings, I should say, is not sustainable. Liz Fosslyn and Molly West Duffy's new book is called Big Feelings, How to Be Okay When Things Are Not Okay. And the book almost didn't happen. Their editors weren't sure if their book premise made a lot of sense, but that was January 2020. The editors changed their minds a few months later. Big Feelings, How to Be Okay When Things Are Not Okay takes a look at the causes and strategies for managing seven categories: uncertainty, comparison, anger, burnout, perfectionism, despair, and regret. They write in the book about big feelings, quote, part of being okay is learning to live with them rather than trying to get rid of them. Another part is acknowledging them out loud, since silence makes them so much worse. Joining us for this edition of Taking Care of You in 22 are Liz Fosslyn. Hi, Liz.
Hi, great to be here.
And Molly West Duffy, co-authors of Big Feelings, How to Be Okay When Things Are Not Okay. Hi, Molly.
Hi, thanks for having us.
I should say welcome back. They have been on the show before, if the names sound familiar. Hey, listeners, what kind of big feelings have you been trying to manage recently? How do you think the last few years have changed your approach to handling your feelings? We'd love for you to get in on this segment. We want to hear your stories. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can always reach out to us on social media. At All of It, WNYC. That's the Twitter handle. If you'd like to remain anonymous, you can DM us on Instagram. That is also at All of It, WNYC. Maybe you have a question about dealing with emotions or a certain problem, and our guest might be able to guide you a bit, sharing some of their research. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9619. Or maybe you have your own strategies and you just want to share with everybody. We like to crowdsource here as well. All right, let's start with Liz. From your research, what are the main reasons people don't engage with their big feelings?
Yes, so many of us have been raised with the notion that big feelings are bad. So Molly and I, when we were conducting research for our new book called Big Feelings, we surveyed about 1,500 people from all around the world, different ages, different backgrounds, and 98% of them said that they had heard emotions like anger, uncertainty, comparison, or envy, which is that emotion, described as bad. And yet, when we also asked that same group, have you felt any of these seven emotions within the last month? Almost every single person said yes. So I think it's this, we just load all this guilt and shame onto these emotions that are actually perfectly normal and part of life. Like, you sign up for life. If you get to live long enough, you will go through really hard periods. You will lose someone you love. You will not get what you want every day. And that can be really hard. And so I think it's really important that we just start to normalize these feelings and stop suppressing them, because that's actually when they fester and get worse, as opposed to when we sit with them, can work through them, can share them, and actually bond with people through that and allow them to support us in really wonderful ways.
Let me dive into uncertainty. That's the first feeling is discussed, which is at its core anxiety, Molly. And there's this great illustration that says anxious fixing. And one arrow says feeling anxious because you're avoiding the problem. And then it points to another arrow. It says avoid the problem because you're feeling anxious, which then leads the arrow back to feeling anxious because you're avoiding the problem. What are some things people can do to break that cycle, Molly?
You brought up anxious fixing, and that's one thing that is really common, but we need to stop doing that. So anxious fixing is all of the small things that we feel like we'll do in the meantime in order to deal with the anxiety. So, you know, it feels good to cross things off your to-do list, but it also means that you're not working through the root cause of your anxiety. So stopping, sitting, and acknowledging the anxiety, the uncertainty that we're dealing with, we can even encourage you to honor it. A couple of ways that you can then move forward. So one is to adopt the mantra, I am a person who is learning blank. And this is a phrase, excuse me, that really helps you say, yes, I may not know how to be a manager in hybrid work right now, or I may not know how to be a new parent, or I'm a nervous wreck, but I am learning how to care for an infant, or I'm learning how to be a great manager, or I'm learning how to move through my emotions. And we start to see ourselves as constantly learning and improving rather than having to know exactly everything that's going to happen in the uncertainty that comes. Another thing that can be helpful is translating your anxiety into specific fears. So anxiety is a generalized fear of many possible things happening, whereas fear is of one thing. So I might have fear of public speaking, for instance, and it's easier to deal with specific fears. You can lay them out, you can make a plan for them, rather than dealing with 100 things that might happen.
I wanted to also follow up on uncertainty. What are some questions, Liz, we can ask ourselves when we feel uncertain to try to feel a little more certain or feel a little more comfortable in the uncertainty?
Yeah, I think one is just, what is the best next step that I can take? I think it can be really grounding to figure out a specific thing you can do to maybe move through that uncertainty. And it might just be, like Molly said, sit with it and just don't keep running from it. One question that we heard from a couple of readers, so we interviewed a lot of readers who read our first book, that they found helpful was, what's the actual worst thing that could happen? And they said that was useful because usually it wasn't so bad. I want to throw a caveat on that. I am incredibly imaginative. I ask myself that. I can come up with a really, really horrible worst case scenario. So the question I like to add to that is, what is the probability that this worst case scenario will happen? Because I can be like, I spill coffee in the kitchen, I forget, I slip, I hit my head, I'm in a coma. Like, it just goes dark really fast. But it's like 0.00001% chance that that would actually happen. So I think it can be grounding to ask yourself, like, hey, this isn't so bad. But if you are one of these catastrophic scenario people like me, I think it's also really useful, like, to assign probabilities to different future scenarios you're afraid of. And that can be, again, calming and kind of help you step away from that fear and anxiety that can take over your whole mindset.
And Molly, before we leave uncertainty, in the book, you myth bust as well, right? So what's a myth you want to bust about uncertainty? There's a couple of them, but give me one.
Yes, absolutely. Well, one of my favorites is that that our anxiety accurately reflects our risk. And this is what Liz was just talking about. But there is a mismatch between how stressed we feel about something and the likelihood of that thing happening. And there's a really great experiment that was run where researchers told one group of people that they had a 99% chance of receiving a painful but safe electric shock. And they told the other group that they had a 1% chance of receiving the shock. And the two groups were willing to pay about the same amount of money to avoid the shock. So in other words, the likelihood of getting hurt didn't affect how anxious people felt about that. They were equally anxious. And in some cases, we're more anxious if we don't know whether something is going to happen. If we know that it's going to happen, we're like, great, I'll just prepare for that thing. And so what that tells us is that, you know, the more uncertainty we face, the worse we feel, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to happen. And so just having that self-knowledge can be helpful in the face of uncertainty.
We're discussing the book, Big Feelings, How to Be Okay When Things Are Not Okay. I'm speaking with its authors, Liz Fosslien and Molly West Duffy. Let's take a call. Beth is calling in from Soho. Hi, Beth. You're on the air.
Wow. I didn't expect to be on the air. In 2016, I went in for knee surgery. Everything went wrong. I died twice. They didn't expect me to live. I don't know if they were farming my organs or what, but long story short, a lot of anger.
Sure.
A lot of anger. It took me more than a couple of years to get even part of my body back because everything atrophied. Major mess.
But anger helped. Anger helped you get back to life. And Beth had told our screeners that she was having trouble getting rid of it now. So Liz, I'm going to ask you, when you have those sort of feelings of anger and you don't seem to be able to get over them, what are a few good first steps?
Yeah, well, first, I'm so sorry that happened to you. I think Molly and I, to a lesser extent, maybe not lesser, but have also gone through kind of chronic pain. And it's Yeah, it's horrifying and it can generate a lot of emotions, despair, anger. I think kind of, yeah, what you alluded to already, which is anger can be a source of motivation. So there's actually research that shows that anger is sometimes a healthier response than fear or despair because it kind of kickstarts us into action. So instead of sinking into it, we're actually motivated to advocate for ourselves, to try to improve our situation. We also often motivated to advocate for others. So there might have been other people in your life who also became angry for you and then were motivated to show up. So I think not the first thing is, again, just to acknowledge that you're feeling angry and accept that a violation did occur. I think that's often, again, because we're socialized, especially women, to not feel angry. It's presented as an ugly and unfeminine emotion. You have like sugar and spice, girls are nice, I butchered it, but that saying. And so just to allow yourself to feel it and then see how you can channel that strategically. And that might be, again, funneling all of it into your recovery, your physical recovery. It might be reaching out to others to see how they can help you. You know, maybe in this case, it's something around like, you know, how can you get compensated for this? There's many different ways, but I think it's don't let it fester. It's again, this translation of a violation did occur. What do I need to feel better? And what steps can I take to address that need?
And can I just add one thing to that? And again, I'm so sorry. And that really resonates with us, Beth. When I go to doctor's offices, I get angry with them quite frequently. And one of the things that I found is communicating my needs at the start of an appointment. So sometimes I will say, I want you to know that it will be more helpful to me if you're honest and tell me that you don't know why I still have pain and you don't know when the pain will go away. And that opens up a door for them to have a different conversation with me than they might have. And as Liz said, I think your experience is valid. And I wonder if there are ways for you to help educate doctors, patients about some of the unexpected things that happened during the surgery so that others don't have to go through what you went through.
My guests are Liz Fosseline and Molly West Duffy. The name of their book is Big Feelings, How to Be Okay When Things Are Not Okay. We'll take more of your calls. We'd like to hear from you. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. What kind of big feelings have you been managing recently? Maybe how you've been managing them can help other people who are listening. After the break, we'll talk a little bit about what burnout is and isn't and how comparison can sometimes be useful. Stay with us. This is All of It on WNYC. My guests are Liz Fosseline and Molly West Duffy. We are talking about their book, Big Feelings, How to Be Okay When Things Are Not Okay. So Molly, I think a lot of burnout's one of the things you write about in the book. And I think people have their own definitions of burnout. But from your research, burnout is specific. It's not just that you're overwhelmed and you have a lot to do. Will you fill out for us what burnout really entails?
Yes, absolutely. It's a complicated clinical definition, but there's three parts of it. So there's exhaustion, which is when you feel constantly depleted. And that's, I think, what many of us would think of as burnout. There's also cynicism, which is when you feel detached from your job and from your coworkers. And then there's ineffectiveness, which is when you feel that you're never able to do a good enough job. And clinical burnout is actually experiencing all three of those dimensions: exhaustion, cynicism, and ineffectiveness. Now, you know, I think you can be feeling very, very exhausted and we can still say you're feeling burned out, but that is the clinical definition.
I want to talk about comparison. Comparison is, you write in the chapter, have you ever been exhilarated about hitting a professional or personal milestone only to find yourself less than 24 hours later having an Instagram-triggered crisis and tumbling down a black hole of I'll never be good enough? Liz, what do we immediately notice about other people when we fall into the comparison hole?
Yeah, so we mainly see and therefore notice their highlight reels. So most people, especially on social media, especially LinkedIn, Instagram, are presenting the very best parts of themselves, and they're going to make a big splash when they get promoted or get a new role, and less of a big splash, if any kind of splash, if they get critical feedback or they, you know, just like burn out of their job. I think that's changing during the pandemic. We've seen more and more conversations starting online and on social media around mental health. But generally, it's still useful to keep in mind that you are seeing the very best parts and that are very curated as well. So it's not an accurate comparison. So you're feeling everything within you, but not seeing everything within someone else. We had one reader we spoke with who said, you know, I can be having a good day and then I go on LinkedIn and everyone's a vice president except for me. And that, you know, that's just, that's not true. Mm-hmm. That's just what it feels like. So I think one thing we talk about in the chapter, though, is that it is useful to clue in a little bit to what are those things that really spike envy within you, that make you kind of nauseous, like this green-eyed monster overtakes you, because it's actually a sign that that's something you might want for yourself. And so it's worth sitting with that a bit and exploring, oh, maybe, you know, if I keep seeing people who are in a creative field and that makes me seethe with jealousy, maybe that's something that you should think about in your next role, that it, you might want to do some more creative work.
As we're talking about creative work, let's talk to Emma on line one from Brooklyn. Hi, Emma. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi. Thank you. I love your show, Allison.
Oh, thanks.
I work with, I'm a musician and artist and also a teacher, and I work with kids, mostly preschool age. And one thing that I love to do with them, I teach violin, and what we do is like, we'll express our emotions on the violin. So like I have a bunch of 4-year-olds all with violins being like, okay, let's play angry. And what's something that makes you feel angry? And then we play like, and they don't need any instruction. Like they know exactly what to do and how to express these different emotions on the instrument. And, I also do the same thing with art, with visual art. And, but I think it's amazing for kids and really to like teach them those ways to express their emotions at a super young age can really stick and make a difference. And I know it has for me in my life. And I think it's something that adults maybe don't think about or don't think they could do, but you don't have to, you know, be an artist or be an amazing musician to like be able to express feelings creatively, like, you know, drawing or whatever it is. And it doesn't have to be, I think sometimes words can fall short. And I think that it's a way to sort of communicate feelings, even just with yourself, that you don't have to overthink it. And,
Emma, thank you for sharing. I really appreciate it. I do want to pick up on the words thing, though, because there's something in the anger chapter I thought was really interesting, that you suggest people identify, if they're angry, they pick a different word than anger. You give a list of words that, so that you can communicate effectively what you're feeling. Liz, would you just share a couple of examples of what you mean by that?
Yes. So those are words like frustrated, irritated, I feel like a violation occurred. And the goal of all of this is to really get granular around your emotions. So we often, because again, I love, by the way, that small children are being encouraged to express their feelings. I think mm-hmm. that's such a step forward for society. But most of us, you know, Molly and I are in our mid-30s, like did not receive that education. And in fact, we were told the opposite of like, no emotions, no big feelings. And so by getting granular, by not just saying I'm angry, but feeling more specific and speaking about that more eloquently helps you better address the need behind that emotion. And there's lots of research that shows when we're able to better articulate exactly what we're feeling, we also feel better. And I think it's because it's easier to move forward. So if I just say to Molly, I'm mad at you, or I'm really angry with you, she's not really going to know what to do with that. But if I say, hey, I'm frustrated that you've been texting me at 2 a.m. every day mm-hmm. or whatever it might be, that's just leading to a much more productive conversation, because I've done that internal work to figure out exactly what's going on. And then I'm expressing it to her in a way that she can quickly understand.
Let's get to Carolyn on line two, calling in from Brooklyn. Hi, Carolyn. You're on the air.
Hi, Allison. Love your show. I'm dealing with grief and anger. Grief because I lost my daughter. Mm. Very angry because an hour before she died, her grandson was born. So she never got to meet him. I'm angry at the hospital. I'm angry at everybody, actually, right now. I'm angry at the people that tell me I shouldn't be angry. And I just don't know what to, you know, how to feel about all of this stuff that's going on.
Caroline, first of all, I'm so sorry. We're so sorry for your loss. I'm glad you called in because maybe our guests can give you some guidelines or some things to think about. Molly, do you want to start? We have a few minutes left.
Sure. Yes, I'm so, so very sorry to hear that. Grief is, you know, you simply come undone. And there's so much that I could say. I think remember that this feeling shattered is normal. The pain will never go away, but it will lessen over the years. I think one of the more recent research that we've liked is that the five stages of grief are more of a messy cycle than a sequential progression. Mm-hmm. And so you will move back and forth between them. And researchers have added a sixth stage to grief, which is meaning. But that meaning is personal and it can take time. And, you know, it may feel that, you know, it's not worth the cost of losing someone, absolutely. But, you know, in time, meaning can replace some of those painful memories. I would love to hand it over to Liz, too, to share.
Yeah, I write a personal story about grief in the book. I lost my father-in-law to cancer. It was a 10-year battle. He had a stroke. And the last couple of days, he couldn't speak, couldn't move. And so I think also just reaching out to people. I think often what I found is that my friends just didn't know how to show up for me. And so it was really useful kind of to think of clear things they could do for me. Like, mm-hmm. Can you just bring me food? Can you just give me a call? Can you just be available if I need to break down? And you don't need to say anything. I just need to know that somebody else will be on the phone and listen to me cry. So I think kind of what Molly said, like, I think often we put pressure on ourselves to move forward. And I don't know if that's happening to you, but I think it's just so, you know, yeah, everything slows to a crawl. And you could, you know, like picking up the groceries, it's like, who cares? What does any of this matter? And I think one thing also, I know we have a couple of minutes, but that helped me a lot was something called time chunking, which is just, you know, there are some evenings where it's like, every minute is excruciating. And so it would be like, take a deep breath, just make it through this minute, make it through the next 5 minutes, go to bed. You know, I would take like a Unisom to mm-hmm. sleep, to be honest. And then with the hope that the next morning I would feel slightly better. And over time I did, but in those really dark moments, it was like, just breathe through this. You just have to put one foot in front of the other. And sometimes it wasn't even a foot. It was like, mm-hmm. I was lying down. And it was one breath after the other.
Yeah, when my father had pancreatic cancer, I remember a doctor told me, left foot, right foot, breathe. Mm-hmm. That's what you have to do. Just to your point, time chunking is really, really helpful. There's so much good advice in the book, Big Feelings, How to Be Okay. Excuse me, When Things Are Not Okay, several good exercises as well. My guests have been Liz Fosslien and Molly West Duffy. Thank you so much for writing this book.
Thank you for having us.